From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Millions invested in the Sandtown neighborhood did not reverse the toll of illegal drugs and vanishing jobs. A week after Freddie Gray's funeral, we asked a journalist and a pastor who was born in Sandtown and lives there still what investments have worked, what has not, and where they see hope now. Then, from Out of the Blocks, the documentary series from The Signal's Aaron Henkin and electronic musician Wendell Patrick, we hear part of their visit to Penn North, recorded 2 days after the riot. And that same day, schools reopened, and we visited a high school in Northeast Baltimore to learn how they were processing the unrest. Plus, theater critic Jaewon Russick talks with Tom Hall about the world premiere musical Dear Evan Hansen, causing a stir at Washington's Arena stage. Now news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. 5 decades ago, before the riots of 1968, Baltimore's Sandtown neighborhood was a vibrant community of about 40,000 laborers, professionals, and artists. These days, less than half that many people live there, and the numbers paint a picture of a community in poor health, with high unemployment, deep poverty, and children not attending school regularly. Yet even with these struggles, the fabric of community relationships holds strong. The combination highlights the depth and stubbornness of the social problems in Sandtown. The week after the riot and protests in April, we were asking the same questions as many residents and outsiders. What can bring stability to this part of West Baltimore? More jobs? Improved housing? Better coordinating leadership among these different groups? To talk about the investment in Sandtown, past and present, Elder Clyde Harris of Newborn Community Faith Church joined me in the studio. He's a native of Sandtown, a pastor, a community activist, and an urban farmer. With us on the line from the Washington Post was Michael Fletcher, who's lived in Baltimore for 30 years and is national economics correspondent for the Post. In May, Fletcher had just co-written an article that the Post headlined, "Why Couldn't $130 Million Transform One of Baltimore's Poorest Places?" That article dealt with the $130 million put together in the 1990s by the City of Baltimore, led by then-Mayor Kurt Schmoke, and developer James Rouse. I asked Michael Fletcher what kind of projects were put in place.
They renovated over 1,000 housing units. They brought together different social service groups. There were renovations done by Habitat for Humanity and others. And the idea was not just to, and they knew this, that they had to do more than sort of transform housing, but that was the first step. But as part of that, the city also tried to launch sort of the kind of social service programs that they hadn't in the past. They had people helping to organize community groups. They had social workers going door to door offering health screenings. They attached other people to the schools. So if a student was absent too much, someone would come and knock on the door and find out why that student wasn't in school. The idea was to uplift the community. You know, it was called the Nehemiah Project, and the idea that just as Nehemiah helped rebuild Jerusalem, the idea was to rebuild Sandtown and do it not just through bricks and mortar, but just through trying to transform lives, which proved to be a very difficult task.
It's a big challenge. Elder Harris, you're a lifelong Sandtown resident, right?
Absolutely.
So you were there. And
I was a part of that movement, started in 1990. And from it developed a nonprofit called Community Builders in Partnership, Inc. Yes, a lot of money was poured into our community. And there were some mistakes made, but some good came out of it also.
What was the good that came out of it?
The good... Every house that was built, that was one less lead-abated home.
One less home with lead in it.
That's right. The Sandtown homes, Sandtown Habitat homes, were geared to people who could not afford homes. Although we had community residents purchasing a nearby home, most of the people came from outside.
So it didn't lift up the original residents of Sandtown as much as you had hoped.
Not really, because they could not afford those homes.
Michael Fletcher, what would you say Sandtown's most pressing problem is now?
It's a combination of things. It's probably hard to single out, but I think sort of the lack of economic opportunity is big, but also all of the problems that spin off of drug abuse and kind of the high incarceration rate. I think these things have torn at kind of the social fabric of Sandtown. But it's interesting, when I was back in Sandtown last week following the disturbances, I was talking to a number of old-time residents, and it's interesting how many people remembered neighbors who used to work at Bethlehem Steel, who worked at the GM plant, who worked in, you know, old industrial Baltimore, which is obviously shrunken when those jobs employed, you know, just armies of people. It made all the difference. People who get substantial employment with really little sort of academic training, and that kind of opportunity is gone. And what's moved in is a sad refrain that we see in many communities, not just throughout Baltimore, but throughout the country, where drugs become kind of almost the economic engine in some ways of the neighborhood. There's a drug treatment center in the community, the Penn North Community Resource Center, that's just a huge enterprise. You know, hundreds of people a day coming for NA meetings, people in residential treatment, and it's all to the good that people are getting treatment. But it's also a sad commentary that you have all of this happening in a building that used to be Frederick Douglass High School.
You have Bright Hope House, which is a part of St. Gregory, and you have my facility, which is Martha's Place for women who are suffering with the addictions of drugs and alcohol. Integration played a part of our community's demise. Our best and brightest, after we became integrated, Baltimore City was able to move anywhere in the United States and live. I could walk two houses away from mine, and I can walk past a home of a professional who's a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, a person of Congress. And we could see that, people waking up in the morning and going to work. And we would say as a child, this is something that we would have to do when we get home. That experience is not seen much in
our
community.
Kids today don't see people getting up and going to work.
I smelled the coffee of my mother and father before I got up in the morning, and I know what was happening. They were getting themselves ready to go to work. And I knew that one day I would have to do the same thing.
Yeah, Sheila, it's interesting. I had a conversation last week with two gentlemen, both guys. They live at the Penn North Center, but they had grown up in Sandtown, and one guy was over 80 years old, the other guy was 69 years old, and these gentlemen talked about their childhood and the people they grew up with. These guys, they readily admit they had taken the wrong path. They ended up in prison, but they said they had friends they grew up with who went on to be lawyers and business people and that kind of thing. You had this kind of social diversity, you know, a generation or two ago, and that kind of thing has all but disappeared from what I can tell in Sandtown. So it makes a huge, huge difference, kind of what you see day to day, what the examples are when you're a young person, and what you see your possibilities as being.
What folk don't understand is that our resources are there. If you look up the 21217 area, check the churches in that area.
The zip code.
And the zip code 21217. And in Sandtown, there are more than 52 church. And that's a lot of resource. I, myself, and along with a newborn and new song alone, it's a few memberships in that church, but we built over 300 homes. We have a 10-point-some-million-dollar school that we built, a $1.1 million facility, Jubilee Arts, that's working with our kids, Martha's Place, and health centers. We did that with two church alone.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking about investment in Sandtown with Michael Fletcher, Washington Post economics correspondent, and Elder Clyde Harris, pastor, community leader, and now an urban farmer. Elder Harris, what do you think could lead to more jobs?
Training. We have an organization that's called Strength of Love 2. we follow the pattern of Delancey Street Project in San Francisco. We work with returning citizens from incarceration. We house them, we feed them, we train them. They learn three trades, and they then themselves can become entrepreneurs and not have to depend on someone hiring them. One of our trades is, as you aforementioned, farming. We have an acre and a half of property that was leased to us by the City of Baltimore. We're in partnership with the City of Baltimore. And I have about 18 hoop farms that is manned.
These are sort of greenhouses made
greenhouses
from big hoops.
That's manned by returning citizens from incarceration.
Michael Fletcher, you're an economics correspondent. What do you think could create more jobs for Sandtown residents?
I think you have to get some kind of training. You have to have better educational outcomes. And that's such a difficult thing because it could become such a cyclical thing. We look at who does best in school. It's the people who have the best support at home and the most affluence at home and that sort of thing. But that's the kind of thing that would make a difference in this current economy that we live in. We could talk a lot about what used to be, but that's not coming back. So you have to have that. And if the neighborhood could have some kind of economic integration, if it could somehow attract kind of a broader range of people, but that's another difficult proposition given sort of the raft of problems from crime and, you know, and the level of drug abuse and all of that. You know, you have to find a way to sort of form a beachhead around that. And that's what's so tragic about sort of the poor relations with the police, because that community needs the police probably more than most in Baltimore. And it's sad that the relations between that community and the police seem to be poisoned. And hopefully that can change.
I'm grateful to both of you for talking to us. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having us, Sheila.
Thank you.
Elder C.W. Clyde Harris of Newborn Community Faith Church, pastor, community leader, urban farmer, who's lived in Sandtown all his life, and Washington Post national economics correspondent Michael Fletcher, who's lived in Baltimore for 3 decades. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Our thanks to Maryland Morning's former senior producer, Lawrence Lanahan, for help in putting this segment together. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, something out of the blocks. Stay tuned for that.
Issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. As we listen back this morning to some of our interviews after the death of Freddie Gray, we also want to revisit how WYPR's The Signal covered the issues days after the riot on April 27th. We're about to hear part of the Out of the Blocks series produced by WYPR's Aaron Henkin with electronic musician Wendell Patrick. And Aaron's here with me. Hi.
Hi, Sheila.
Tell us about Out of the Blocks.
Out of the Blocks, the simplest way to describe it is one city block, 1 hour of radio, everybody's story. The concept, we make it our assignment to meet and interview everybody on one city block in Baltimore, and we cut together all their voices, all their lives, all their stories into 1 hour, and it essentially becomes the story of that entire block.
So what we're about to hear, I mean, a lot of the looting and fires that followed Freddie Gray's funeral April 27th took place in the Penn North neighborhood. How was your approach there and then different from some of the other blocks you visited?
Well, I can explain it this way. Up to this point, there's been about a 2.5 year gap of time between each episode of Out of the Blocks. We turned this Penn North Out of the Blocks around in 4 days, just because of the situation and the timeliness of what was going on there. I just went down there to that block at the intersection of Pennsylvania and North Avenue, where the famous burnt CVS was that the world saw from the helicopter's eye view. And I taped to one side of a clipboard, I taped the words public radio reporter, and to the other side of the clipboard, I taped the words let your voice be heard. And I just wandered up and down the streets in the 3-block radius around that epicenter for a day and just let people come to me. And people had things on their mind, obviously, that they wanted to say.
And that's some of what we get to hear now. Thank you, Aaron. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
Here's a cut from Aaron Henkins' Out of the Blocks, recorded in Penn North on Wednesday, April 29th.
We got, like, troops out this motherfucker, man. Like, real out this, you hear me? Yo, all for what? I'm T, right here on North and Cary. This the roughest thing that you can think of right here. This the jungle. This is what we come up in. Like, you gotta be here.
My name is Priscilla. I live in this community.
What do you fear is the worst possible thing that could happen from here?
No conviction, no justice, no trial. And just sit back and wait, world. The best is yet to come. And that's scary and it frightens me. My mom lives in another city and state. And because I live right here at Ground Zero, I did tell her, me and my family, we might have to flee. If it comes to that, like, I'm actually kind of crying here. We might have to flee because of the fear in our community.
I've been watching the helicopters fly around for the last 3 or 4 days. I've been watching the police and the fire engines and all that coming up and down the street. And I haven't been down there because I don't want to be a part of none of that.
Will you tell me your name?
Sean Wiggins.
There's a lot of talk, this theory about this police rough ride, like that might have been, you know, Freddie Gray, and the way he died might have been because of the way they were, like, driving the van crazy. Is that something you guys had heard of before?
Yeah.
Like this police practice?
There's many police paddy wagons, and it's like they take the bumpiest road possible to get you to central booking or the district, wherever they're trying to get you. It's like they take the bumpiest streets possible. They have seat belts in the back of the vans. I've never been strapped in a seat belt. When I've been in the paddy wagon, I'm actually glad if it's 3 or 4 more people back in there so I won't slide as much. We kind of hold each other in place. You know, but it's very possible that police ride was bumpy and he got the bumping around in there because it looked like to me he was already injured when he first got in the wagon. It looked like he was dragging his leg. You know, so that very well could have been it.
Hey, man, my name is Johnny Johnson, man. I'm right here on North and Fulton, man. It hurt because it's a community, man, and we destroying it, don't get me wrong, but at the same time, it's just a reaction of the corruption that we deal with on a daily basis, man. And you put a man in a corner, man, you keep putting a man in a corner, and eventually, man, is going to want to react and get out of that corner, man. So this is just the reaction of the corruption, man. We dealing with it every day, man, every day, man.
My name is Kelly Jones, North Avenue in Monroe. What my thing is I'm scared of is I have a 2-year-old. I don't want him to grow up and think it's okay, the behavior that people was doing. I mean, Monday night, it was like a scary movie. Like, my 25 years of living, I never seen nothing like that, looting or anything, fires. I mean, from the CVS getting burnt down, from bars getting burnt down. I mean, it's been ridiculous. And now I gotta contemplate where I'm gonna get my son Pampers from because mostly all the places been looted.
They stole all my cigarette, the baby formula, and broke you see the ATM right there? They took the money from the ATM too. My name is Tina. My source name is Sosta Maki. My address is 2045 West North Avenue. I called the police. they cannot do nothing for me. Nobody will come, no police will come to my small store because my store is small.
And then we saw that one police car and then drive down right there. We tried to stop him and then we need some help, but he not stop. That's not supposed to happen in America, you know?
Tell me where you guys are from.
I'm from China, but right now I feel that America very bad.
I don't know.
It's just heartbreaking because now that you did all you did, you don't tore up your neighborhood. Now what? Is Freddie back here? No, he's not. Doing all this disruptors in your neighborhood is not going to do anything but make all the stereotypes that they say about us in this neighborhood come true. Lena Shaw, I'm at Norfolk Pulaski at Cary Hardware. If these cops or the guilty people get off on this, it's telling the youth, the radical youth, that no matter what, they're not going to get justice, or they can do what they want to do because they're going to get in trouble no matter what. And it's going to be turmoil.
Hi, my name is Ike. We on Fulton Avenue. And my outlook on the whole situation is that if the mayor would do better for her city, then the kids wouldn't go off.
Tell me what you're doing right now and what you're getting ready to do.
I'm ready to clean out this trash can. They got a lot of liquor bottles and trash that we put in there. I'm just ready to put it in this bag.
Let me ask you to just talk a little bit about what you saw, heard, and experienced in this neighborhood, like on Monday night, and what it's been like since.
Monday, it was cars on fire. People running in and out of buildings. People running, a lot of police officers everywhere, running up and down the street. It was just a lot.
What was going through you that night, and as you sort of looked out your front window and saw this happening, like in basically your, you know, on your own block?
People was taking matters into their own hands because we unheard. Like, people don't hear us. So they hear us now because they tearing up the city. Now they want us to do it in, you know, in a peaceful way. But in a peaceful way, you don't get nowhere sometimes. I don't condone them messing up the city, but I'm glad that they did do something to be heard.
Why do you think this happened? Like, what's the big picture? Why did this go down?
Because the police is killing our young black men and ain't suffering no consequences from killing the men. And then our mayor, she basically is for herself. She's not even for the people, because it shouldn't have to take them to come out here and mess up the city for her to want to come out and say something positive. Then she called us animals. Like, I think somebody else needs to be in office instead of her.
What do you think is going to happen, like, tonight and tomorrow night and, you know, into next week? Is this going to be a regular routine with tear gas and cops and National Guard in the street? What do you see is going to happen next?
I see they calm down a lot, so it shouldn't be no more riots and none of that. But I still think they're going to protest until they get the verdict of what's going to happen with Freddie Gray.
How you doing? My name is Jeffrey Downing. We right here on Pulaski and North Avenue. I actually challenged the mayor and the commissioner. You know, it's a lot of brothers like me and myself. We ex-cons and stuff like that, and it's kind of hard to get employment right now. A lot of us have good ideas. We able, and we were looking for a break to some help so we can get some jobs, and so it won't be it's kind of violence and unnecessary anger at those in authority. And I challenged the mayor and those in authority to find some kind of resources for us so we can get the rec centers going. And I have a lot of brothers as myself that would love, you know, to work with the police and the young brothers and all together so we can better the community.
Tell me about what you saw, heard, experienced Monday night. Were you near or around or in the violence?
Actually, I drove through, and it was kind of sad. It was really sad to see that everything that I love was being destroyed, you know. But I understand on both sides. There's a lot of anger for the young brothers that see what the world don't see here in Baltimore is that we get it bad from the police. And it's sad that a brother had to die before the world took notice. No, we didn't do it the correct way. We didn't handle the right way. Some of us did, most of us did, but some of us didn't, you know. But that's my whole point, is that the mayor have to come to guys like us to work with her to help the young brothers in the community so they can see something a little better, you know. And we can teach them. And we don't mind working with the police as long as they're doing the right thing, you know. And we don't mind to help the police, you know, to teach the brothers the right way of living.
Let me ask you a question about whether or not what you've seen and experienced this week has given you the feeling that things are going to change.
It has to change. Because we can't. I heard somebody say, so we can get back to normalcy. We don't want to get back to normalcy. We want the things to change for the better. I love my city, and I think that if those in authority will just put more resources here where we at, I mean, things will change. It's a great community, and it's a lot of hard brothers like me that want to go to work and support our family and be in our kids' lives and show the younger brothers that and sisters that it's a better way than violence and destroying a neighborhood.
My first name is Lawrence. That's all I'm gonna give to you. I was here in 1968 when the riots came through here from Martin Luther King. I was two blocks up then. I remember it explicitly when the big trucks rolled through and the army and all of those guys were coming through here. After chaos has taken its course, there is a calming, there's a settling, and hopefully we can learn from that.
Baltimore just gotta get it together. East, west, south, north, everybody gotta get it together at once. Come on. Come on, Baltimore, wake up. Let's get it together.
That segment about Penn North from Out of the Blocks was produced by Aaron Henkin with electronic musician Wendell Patrick. We have a link to Out of the Blocks at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Stay tuned this fall for more episodes of Out of the Blocks. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, a Baltimore City teacher tells of guiding her students following the unrest. Stay with us on 88.1.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Monday. That means it's time for our weekly theater review with our Maryland Morning theater critic, Jay Wynn Russick. Hey, Judy, good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So most of the time we talk about musicals, and we do that a lot. They're musicals that even I know, and I don't follow musical theater all that closely. But we're going to talk about one called Dear Evan Hansen. It's at Arena Stage, and I guess the reason I don't know it is because it's a world premiere.
Right.
What can you tell us about this fellow, Evan Hansen?
Well, I want to say right from the top, Tom, that this is indeed a brand new musical, and Arena Stage has put on a super production. So Evan Hansen, as you can guess from the title, is the protagonist. The musical has a script by Steve Levinson and a score by Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. Evan is a high school senior. He is a very ill-at-ease kid, and he is played absolutely magnificently by an actor named Ben Platt. Ben starred in the Pitch Perfect movies, and he happens to be the 21-year-old son of Baltimore native Mark Platt, who is known around these parts, certainly, because he produced Wicked.
Yeah,
yes.
He's from Pikesville.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Yep.
So Ben, as Evan Hansen, has all of the character's nervous mannerisms. He has an anxious laugh. He's blinking. He doesn't know what to do with his hands. He's seeing a psychiatrist, and as part of his therapy, the psychiatrist assigns him to write pep talk letters to himself, letters that start, "Dear Evan Hansen." Now, there's also a kid at school named Connor who's kind of a mean, scary loner. I don't want to give too much away. I will say, however, that an unexpected bond develops between Evan and Connor's family, and Evan gets caught up in a whole tangled web of lies. Evan also happens to have a crush on Connor's younger sister, Zoe, and I brought you Evan's first solo. This is a real powerful song about what it feels like to be an outsider.
I try to speak, but nobody can hear, so I wait around for an answer to appear while I'm watching people pass. Waving through a window, oh, can anybody see? Is anybody waving?
Waving Through a Window from the Arena Stage production of the new musical Dear Evan Hansen. That's Ben Platt in the title role singing. That gives us a little taste of the score. Sounds pretty good to me. What's the score like overall?
Well, Tom, as you could tell sort of from that song, it has a very hard-driving pop rock sound, but it stays within musical theater convention. So the score builds character and it moves the plot along. Evan isn't a character who's comfortable talking to people, so that the emotions that he can't speak get expressed in song. For example, in the first act...
Well, that's kind of a perfect setup for a musical, isn't it?
Oh, it is. In the first act, he sings a song called If I Could Tell Her, about his feelings for Zoe. And in the second act, he has a big confessional scene with Zoe and Connor's parents, and he sings a song called Words Fail. But the songs are not just inner monologues. There are also sung emails. I should mention there are a lot of projections on stage. We see emails as they're being written, and the internet and postings are major components in the set and in the plot. They become deliberately overwhelming, almost blinding. And there's also a traditional romantic duet for Evan and Zoe, and I brought that. Zoe is played by Laura Dreyfus.
Maybe it's possible, nobody else but the two of us here. Say that it's possible.
We could just watch the whole world disappear.
That's Ben Platt and Laura Dreyfus. They're singing Only Us from the new musical Dear Evan Hansen. Now, this sounds like a fairly intimate show. It's a story of a troubled teen. Is there enough meat on them bones to sustain an entire musical?
Well, in this case, definitely. This is a really heartbreaking, heart-wrenching show. It focuses on one boy, but it touches on issues that are affecting lots of families. Single parenthood, the impact, and it can be a pretty negative impact, of cyberspace and Facebook, particularly on kids who already feel that they don't fit in. The issue of teen suicide shows up wrenchingly and prominently. Besides Evan, there are four other teenage characters, and three of them, particularly Connor, feel like outsiders. And there are some really gripping performances by the actors playing adults as well as the actors playing teens. I should say the direction is by Michael Greif, who also directed Rent and Next to Normal, so he knows something about young people and families in crisis.
Yeah, it's a good pedigree. I mean, it's interesting, you know, they've got singing emails, and they're talking about the internet, and they're talking about the things that every teenager since time eternal goes through, so it sounds like they're hitting all the right buttons. You sound very positive about this show. Arena Stage is the first folks to do it. What are the chances, in your view, that Dear Evan Hansen will move on from Washington to other places?
I think the chances are very strong. For one thing, there's an outside producer involved. And judging from the program notes by Arena Stage's executive producer, that's what everybody expects. I have to say the show still has some rough edges. The ending feels too hopeful, more than is warranted by what we've seen before. And if we are talking about New York, and I think we are, I think the show needs another out-of-town stop first, maybe at another regional theater where the creators can do a little more fine-tuning. But Tom, Dear Evan Hansen already has lots going for it, and it has all the elements to attract not just standard graying musical theater audiences, but I would say it's pitch perfect to attract a younger, hipper demographic. It's already an exciting show. Go see it.
All right. Dear Evan Hansen, it's at the Arena Stage in Washington through Sunday. J. Bryn Russick, always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll have complete information on our website. Come on over to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us.
Good for you. You got a taste of a life so perfect, so you did what you had to do. Good for you. Good for you. Good for you. Good for you. So you got what you always wanted.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. After the protests and riot on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral, Monday, April 27th, Baltimore City Public Schools closed the next day. School CEO Dr. Gregory Thornton sent a press release to families thanking the many students who got home safely and encouraging parents to talk with their children about events in the city. He pledged that students found to have engaged in rioting would be prosecuted. When schools reopened that Wednesday, our producer, Jonna McCone, went to City Neighbors High School in Northeast Baltimore to get a sense of how the students and the school were processing recent events.
City Neighbors High School is a tiny charter school of close to 400 students tucked away in a quiet neighborhood. But like most Baltimore high schools, the students come from all over. When you walk in the school, there's a large white banner in the hallway that says,
"What do you want people or the media to know about you as a Baltimore youth?"
Anaya Clark reads the banner in the school's main hallway. On the paper are comments students have written, scribbled in pen and different marker colors.
Some of the stuff that's on our poster, like when you enter the building, is stuff like, "I'm not a thug." People need to change things in a more mature manner. I want them to know that we are not as what people portray us to be. We are humans. We're not animals. We have a brain. We're very smart. We're not thugs, so don't look at us that way.
Clark is a junior. She tells me she plans to go to Baltimore City Community College, and eventually she wants to be a gynecologist. She says Baltimore youth have been portrayed as students having low standards, but this sign?
When you put things up like this, people gonna read it. It's eye-catching, so that's it.
City Neighbors students and teachers spent much of yesterday trying to work through this week's unrest.
Monday was awful.
Tamara Jolly teaches 11th grade at City Neighbors.
I was on the news at 3 o'clock. I took the live feed from the mall over to my vice principal. I showed her what was going on, and immediately we said, "How do we get our kids home safe?" So we started figuring out what kids take buses that switch at the mall, what kids live nearby. We were just sending them home with parents that were willing to take them, carpool after carpool. I saw parents running into the building with faces that I'll never forget, fear.
When she got home, she turned on her TV.
And I just started weeping because I felt like I couldn't defend them anymore. I had tried to defend them for so long of how wonderful the kids I teach are. And for the first time, I saw children, some students that I had recognized from other schools that I had taught, and I said, I don't know how to defend them to the media, to my friends, to my family anymore. And I knew it wasn't my kids. I knew it was just a small group, but I knew how other people would see it, and I felt lost.
She spent the rest of the night texting kids and their families to make sure her students were okay. On Wednesday, that frustration was channeled into a day of community building at City Neighbors. The school embarked on projects like the word wall we heard about earlier. The school's principal, Mr. Dolly, is organizing visits from community leaders. And on Friday, there will be an all-school assembly. Ms. Jolly's students discuss the events as they sit on a few couches in the front of her classroom.
Anaya, you came to me earlier with a really upset. Do you want to share with everyone what we were talking about?
I got upset because when Stephanie Rollins Blake got on national TV and called us thugs. I'm not a thug. When I got out of school Monday at 4 o'clock, I was home. I'm a young African-American child who was 16, and I'm still in school trying to do the right thing. I want to become something in life. So you putting that thug slang out on the edges, that make people looking at us bad. And we already, us as African-American kids, we already get labeled as, being unsuccessful. We're not going to make it in life. We live in the hood. We don't have nothing. So being called a thug was just, like, disrespectful to me because I'm a African-American who trying to become something in life. So I decided that I was going to start a hashtag, I'm not a thug.
The students discussed responses like Anaya's I am not a thug hashtag. A hashtag is a label used on Twitter to organize tweets. They also talk about their frustrations with the news media and public officials. Though the school gave the teachers suggestions on how to facilitate students sharing personal experiences, Jolly still came into school yesterday anxious.
What do we tell them? They're going to come in seeing that the violence and the rage and the burning got them attention.
And she says that despite being unsure of how to lead their classes, teachers still came together.
Even if the school wasn't organized, so many teachers took it upon themselves to make this a focus of the day. Even if a principal didn't say you need to, I know tons of teachers that were on the phone emailing their teams, whether it was a grade level team or their content teams, talking about how to best go about handling it.
But she also points out that navigating discussions on how police relate to youth aren't new.
For years, I've had students come to me and have stories of just standing outside of 7-Eleven. They come in with a bruise on their arm or a bruise on their back, and they're like, oh, I'm in pain. I was like, what's wrong? Oh, the cops threw me down. And I was asked them, what did you do? And a lot of times it was refuse to move or something similar like that.
Today, she says she felt torn between sympathy and her role as an educator to support her students emotionally and direct them in positive ways. Back in her classroom, she prompts another student, Lewis Dixon.
Do you want to comment a little bit on your thoughts that you were sharing earlier?
Personally, it saddens me to know that, you know, I'll never be able to walk the streets the way I did last week again, you know. I remember I was at 7-Eleven this morning getting my usual, you know, something to drink, donut, breakfast, something like that. And then, you know, it was a cop in there, and he gave me like the dirtiest look.
This is a trauma to them, without a doubt.
Again, Tamara Jolly.
So not only is it traumatizing that they're upset about the death of a young man in the city, and they're upset about the fear that this may not be just, you know, and what led to it. They're upset that they had to see their city burn. So they're mad at everything. They're mad that people are tearing their city down, but they're mad that their voices aren't heard. They're mad that these issues exist. They're mad that they see their community from a bird's eye view for the first time, and they don't like the way it's being portrayed.
Being at City Neighbors as school lets out and seeing young people flit around the school, chatting and laughing, is a reminder of how resilient kids are, but they also seem willing to engage in important discussions. I asked Ms. Jolly how, as a teacher, she knows when her responsibilities as an educator end.
I think this brings to light the incredibly complex job of an educator, especially an educator in a situation that we're in, as well as in an urban school district. We are not teachers. We are mentors, we are emotional supporters, we are providers. We do way more than come in and teach a lesson.
She adds that students don't realize how many things schools do that aren't just about education. They often provide 3 meals a day, normalcy, structure, and a safe place to be. Reporting from City Neighbors High School in Baltimore, I'm Jonna McCone.
We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production of
Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Jonna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. Yesterday was August 16th, the day in 1948 that George Herman Babe Ruth, the formidable left-handed batter, died of cancer. He'd been born in Baltimore 53 years earlier. We're back on Wednesday. Hope you will be too.